At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
Only one movie has been accidentally small recommended twice by me on Wreckatopia. Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
If I don't go into the black with Coven, if I don't make money back off of Coven, how the hell am I going to make Northwestern? I've got to make money back on Coven. So when I did these figures, 500, 1,000, 2,000, and 3,000 units, right? I said, check this out. Fuck this, man. I'm sorry for erasing that, but it's 3,000 units for 45 grand.
Hello, everybody. It's episode yes. And Aaron has once again thrown a monkey wrench into the show. Welcome to episode 143 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by the aforementioned Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, America Renos.
And also joined by Jeremy Scott.
Colvin,
yes, Colvin. Indeed. Yes, and even though our Wreckatopia thing says it's American Dream, it's actually American Movie.
You're welcome.
That we are doing today from 1999. It's our big recommend. And yes, I'm glad the chat has gotten on that. There was a comment that said, I don't get mockumentaries. This is not a mockumentary. This is a documentary with funny stuff in it. This was not scripted, at least not in the traditional way.
I can absolutely see why people would think this was scripted and faked and waiting for Guffman-esque, but it's not. This is like, these are real people.
Yeah. So that's going to be the big recommend today. And a welcome chat, the aforementioned chat. Jeez, I'm saying aforementioned way too much, really way too much. But thank you, chat, for coming out here and watching us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Start us off on the small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Mine is L.A. Story from 1991. Steve Martin is a weatherman who falls in love with this reporter from the U.K. who wants to write a story about Los Angeles, whatever's going on in the early 90s. And then Steve Martin wrote this script, and it's just a really funny look at L.A. back in the day. There's scenes in there where they're having dinner and an earthquake happens and everybody just continues having their conversations like nothing's going on. And like, oh, what is that? A 5.4? Yeah, something like that. Maybe a 5.3, you know, whatever. But he falls in love with this reporter who was played by Victoria Tennant, who was his wife at the time, his actual real life wife at the time. He's kind of in a I guess he's married to Mary Lou Henner, but they're in a kind of relationship where it's like things have kind of gone south and whatever, and she's cheating on him anyway, and he starts to date. There's a point where he meets the reporter, and he asks the reporter out, but the reporter says, I'm just here to do a story, plus I'm also involved with this guy, and that guy's played by Richard E. Grant in a pretty funny performance. So as you can see, Sarah Jessica Parker is in the image. He starts dating Sarah Jessica Parker, who's like a clothing store girl of some sort, and like they have their own. She's got her own things going on. She's even like got a boyfriend or something who's into it. The fact that she's dating somebody else. So there's a lot of stuff like that. But really, what you come to LA Story for is all the like It's almost an airplane type movie.
Yeah.
In cases, in some places. But it's really subtle how they do it a lot of times. Like sometimes it's not so subtle, but other times it's like there's a slow motion shower scene and it looks very, very straight laced and serious and blah, 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 whatever you want to call it. And just a brief frame of a moment, he goes over and turns his shower off and it says slow mo, has a slow motion like setting on the shower. So there's stuff like that in there, but basically you have a talking street sign that tells him what he needs to do and gives him riddles to solve and things like that. It's a really, really funny movie. I had not seen this in forever. I saw it in theaters and then I hadn't seen it probably since then, even though I know that I really liked it. So there you go.
I've seen this movie a few times back in the day. I love the ATM when he leaves the ATM and is immediately robbed. He's like, "Hi, my name's Bob. I'll be your robber today." And he's like, "Oh, hi, Bob." And his hands over his money. Yeah.
It's just par for the course. You just give your money over to people. Like, why would you even go to get money at that point is what you sit there and think. But, you know. There you go. And this was directed by Mick Jackson, who later did Volcano, which has a lot of the same like weird LA stuff mm-hmm. in it. And it's like Volcano is one of those weirdly comic movies, even though it seems like it's doing a straight-laced disaster movie. It's still got like funny stuff in it too about LA.
I mean, ends on the yeah. What's his name? The Toy Story song guy,
Randy Newman.
Randy Newman. It ends on a Randy Newman song. I think it mm-hmm. ends on I Love L.A. Isn't that the song?
I can't remember. I can't remember, actually.
Yeah, I watched.
Winking at you.
I watched this. This I was ticking off this year movies that I think maybe I saw, but that I don't really remember well enough to say for sure if I did, and this was one of them. And I watched this back in January, and man, did I love it. It's so... Just the little dabble of the like mystical stuff is like a perfect balance for me. Like it doesn't overwhelm the movie or distract from the human element of it or the character development. So yeah, I had a great time. Plus, you know, Patrick Stewart does a French accent and that's, yep. you know, worth the price of admission alone. So
yeah. That's a whole thing there too with him trying to be good enough for the restaurant, mm-hmm. like basically interviewing to go to the restaurant. That's mm-hmm. what, there's a thing in there for that. So yeah, it's really funny.
Yeah, it's great. I can go next. Okay. I'm going to do a small recommend for a movie that I apologize. I don't know where you can see it, when you can see it. This is my world for these last couple months. But it is called Hard Truths. And this is the Mike Lee's latest film. And man, did this one put me on my knees. I really, really like a movie that can somehow manage to have almost zero plot, but still engage you in the character's world so intently that you are just in it throughout. And I think that's this kind of movie. There's very little going on plot-wise about this character. Everybody kind of ends up in the same place as, you know, where they started, all that kind of stuff. But we are following this woman, played by Jean-Marion Baptiste, who put her in the nominations right now. She's incredible in this movie, and she's overdue for winning an Oscar, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But she plays this woman named Pansy, who is just one of those people that seem to hate everybody and everything. And it is about her world... not necessarily about how she got that way, but there's little hints as to, you know, what's going on psychologically with her. But more than anything, it's just a human story of what it's like to be at this level of discomfort with the world. And it really slapped me across the face. I came out of it just gobsmacked by the emotion and the intensity and the depth of it. So when you do get a chance to see it, I would highly recommend Hard Truths when it pops on your radar.
Excellent. Sounds good.
I feel like I'm finally old enough to watch Mike Lee movies because back in the 90s.
You're right.
You know what I mean? Like back in the 90s, I watched, you know, I would watch a Mike Lee movie and I was like, oh, what the hell is everybody so excited about this for? But now you get all the things that he's doing with the movie when you're like older. And
I think that's right.
Oh, that's hilarious. All right, my small recommend this week is not a movie. It's a rapper. I discovered this dude on Instagram, but he's also on Twitch and YouTube, and his name is Harry Mack. And he can do what freestyle rappers for decades have been pretending to do, which is to say he can freestyle rap, not spitting bars that he's had in his back pocket, but actually, so what he does, his most of his videos, he's in a public place, he goes up to a group of 5, 10, 15 people and says, I'd like to do a freestyle rap for you, but I need you to give me some interesting and bizarre words for me to work into the rap. And so he'll get stuff like psychotic, and he'll get all kinds of weird words. But in addition to working those words into the rap that he then does, he works in what people are wearing, brands, clothing, colors, headphones, what have you. It took maybe two videos for me to believe this is not fake. This is real. And he does all kinds of different flows and cadences, different beats. And I am amazed. I keep telling everybody I know about this guy because he actually can do what you think Eminem is doing at the end of 8 Mile. And he does it over and over and over again to prove that he's doing it. The other reason I want to recommend this guy is he's got a podcast called Flow State where he interviews people like Bobby Flay and Rainn Wilson. And sometimes it's just him. And this dude is profound. Like, he has a really good way with words in talking about growth as a rapper, as a writer, as an artist. He started out as a drummer, I believe, and talks a lot about how his drumming informs his rapping now. So just lots of really good nuggets of wisdom. And it's just one of the best follows I've ever made since I started Instagram. And I'm just amazed every time I see his videos. And so I wanted to let you guys know about Harry Mack. If you think The End of 8 Mile is awesome, I think you'll freaking love this guy. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds pretty awesome. I'll have to give him a look at some point. For sure. I always like it when people take a, you know, something that is not very, it's not very like easy to, I mean, I guess, you know, you probably practice this forever and ever and ever and you get good at it, but geez, what point do you start? What point did you get to that? You know, what age did he start?
I guess the first video he ever had that went viral, he was driving and his friend was filming him and basically challenged him to do a freestyle right then and there. And it came out better than either of them expected it to. And then he talks on his podcast a lot about how his brain works and how he creates lyrical branches and how he can sort of see where the rhyme is going before he gets there. His brain is doing savant-like things, I think. I do believe he is on another level and that this is not something everyone can learn how to do. But anyway.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
All right. I will go on to our big recommend, which is American Movie from 1999, and this is mine, so I will take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
American Movie is a 1999 documentary directed by Chris Smith. The movie begins in the suburbs of Milwaukee with our main subject, Mark Borchardt, who is tired of being what he perceives as a failure. He laments not having made his movie masterpiece yet, despite having several chances to do so. The lament seems to be something that is common among many people pursuing their dreams, all the desire but a lack of motivation, time, and money. The next person we meet is Tom Schimmels, a local actor who has appeared in other Mark Borchardt productions, including a radio show, where he learned of other projects swimming around in his head. We are taken to the year 1995, where Mark is trying to finish up a script for a Halloween radio show mere minutes before it's recorded. He's got people putting up scarecrows outside for what appears to be for no reason. We are also introduced to his longtime friend Mike Shank, a lovable guy who's definitely done a lot of drugs in his life, but has recently decided to take the path of sobriety. He mentions he's always helped out with whatever production Mark is doing, but there's been a lot of partying during that time too, which is probably a good reason why Mark hasn't finished his American masterpiece yet. This is also hammered home when Mark later admits that he wasn't paying attention to the actors during the radio show because he was smoking dope and drinking beer the whole time. He says to the documentary filmmakers while he throws newspapers out of his car, mentioning the movie he really wants to make is called Northwestern. As if the partying during the radio show isn't enough, we are also introduced to Mark's overdue bills threatening legal actions, while the documentary's visuals focus on numerous scripts and books about movies, showing Mark's passion isn't just some whim with absolutely no basis in film appreciation. The kicker to this is that when Mark finishes opening up all these letters that show he's not very responsible with money, MasterCard is still willing to give him a chance. After that prelude, the movie focuses on Mark's efforts to make Northwestern. So he's doing casting calls and setting up production meetings. We are introduced to Mark's Swedish mother, Monica, who establishes that Mark has wanted to be a filmmaker for a long time, his brother, Alex, who talks about Mark plastering horror movie ads everywhere in his room, and finally his brother, Chris, who explains that Mark got his first film camera from a neighbor and that it shot things out of focus, but it allowed him to do what he wanted to do. Mark's production meetings seem to have the dreaming part of the movie-making process down, but not the particulars. When props and special effects guy Dean Allen asks whether Mark has the funding to make this movie, Mark is focused on what it's going to be like when Dean gets to see this beautifully made feature on a drive-in screen. We are also introduced to another childhood friend, Ken Keen, who describes shooting Mark's first movie, The More the Scarier, in a cemetery back in 1980. Shank tells us he was in the More the Scarier 3, a movie series that we will find out has at least 4 entries by the end. In a small scene that encapsulates a lot of Mark's deal, what Mark's deal is in this movie, he's scouting filming locations while name-dropping films like Manhattan and The Seventh Seal for the kind of backdrops he's looking for. And once again, the dream has more focus than the movie itself, as Mark talks about all the assistant directors he's going to have around telling people to stand back while he shoots this movie. During the casting call, we are given a lot of amateur actors reading bad dialogue that even Mark's overacting can't save. Soon after, we're whisked to a local airport where Mark works on a script in a car in a parking lot, claiming that when he's there are no distractions, so he has to write or else. We're on the third draft of Northwestern, and Mark seems to understand that his dialogue is weak and it needs a punch-up so he can hand it out without being embarrassed. Now we are given a true treasure in this film, Mark's Uncle Bill, who's old as fuck. Mark needs money from Bill, who doesn't really know what any of this is, but definitely has a soft spot for his nephew. We are also introduced to Mark's dad, Cliff, who tells us that Bill is very tight with his money, but Mark has the skills necessary to get his uncle to donate. The movie humorously suggests that when Mark shows some publicity photos of an actress who's going to be in the movie, that's when Bill decides to fork over the dough. Another production meeting introduces us to Tom Beach, the production manager who is everything Mark isn't, professional. And not too long after that, it sounds like communications have broken down between Mark and the rest of the crew, and the film's production seems to be at risk. It's definitely at risk when the fourth meeting is called and only one other person shows up for it. During that meeting, though, Mark says something that I feel like I've taken very much to heart during the CinemaSins era. No one has ever paid admission to see an excuse. No one has ever faced a black screen that says, well, if we had these set of circumstances, we would have shot this scene, so please forgive us and use your imagination. Northwestern is dead for now. He doesn't have the time or money to do this. Mark's family and friends sum up Mark as best as they can, a guy who's smart, but didn't finish high school, has great powers of persuasion, but not much in the way of organization, and that he joined the army and even that didn't straighten him out. Ken Keen then explains that when he returned, after a couple of short films, Mark's attention was directed to a movie called Colvin, which Mark abandoned a couple of years ago, but now sees as a way to make the money he needs to finally get on track to make Northwestern. Colvin's story revolves around an alcoholic who goes to a support group that turns out to be a cult. On to some more financials with his Uncle Bill. where they set up a special account at the bank that only Bill controls whenever he decides money can be released. Bill is suspicious of it and has no idea what is going on, but ends up agreeing reluctantly. Although Coven will be an easier task than Northwestern, it's clear Mark's usual approach to making movies is going to call even this project's completion into question. Mark tries to get people to work for him at the last minute and imposes on people who don't have the time to give. However, he is getting some shooting done, and it's more than we could say for Northwestern. Movie then introduces us to Joan Petrie, who is the location scout slash associate producer slash Mark's girlfriend. We are given the lowdown on Mark's personal life. He's got three kids from a former girlfriend named Alyssa, and there's a fourth kid throwing around there, too. I don't know if that's his or not. Maybe from another mother. I don't know. But there's a fourth kid somewhere in there, too. Starting things up with Joan has complicated things for him with his former partner and his visitation rights. We get to see some more filming. The hilarious thing is, in the middle of all this, his props guy, Dean Allen, is openly wondering why Mark has switched his attention to Coven over Northwestern, meaning even now there are people in the dark about why Mark is doing what he's doing. Tom Schimmels talks about a shot where his head goes through a cupboard, and he hopes that it only needs one take. But it's no surprise that the shot is attempted several times before they get the scoring just right to make it happen.
I shouldn't have been trying to put your head through that.
I should have never put your head through this. You should have never done this, man. What a trooper Tom is. He even explains how he has to fit this movie into his schedule and strikes a balance not to leave too early because he knows this is Mark's dream. Okay, regarding the Coven title, one of Mark's regulars, the tremendously over-the-top Robert Richard George, tells him it should be pronounced like coven usually is, but Mark rejects that on the grounds that it sounds like oven. Mark tells us his biggest movie influences are Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, citing the look of the films. Also, we find out Mark has been showing his young kids movies like Apocalypse Now. More money problems. Mark lays out a series of bills he has to pay, including $10,000 to his dad, who has cut Mark off from any more borrowing, especially since he's not 100% on board with the movie, which has a lot of bad language, and Mark's continuing battle with alcohol. While his brother Alex wonders aloud why anyone would be interested in anything Mark does, we see a montage of older films Mark did that includes a killer hiding himself under a pile of leaves to make a surprise kill. We get to Thanksgiving 1996, and so the movie frames Mark's last few months before finishing Coven with several dashes of Green Bay Packers highlights. This is where we see more of Mark's personal life and his rapport with his Uncle Bill. Mark gets his uncle drunk and even helps bathe him. We see what a stabilizing presence Mike is. And we see Mark's got everyone helping him with this film, even his mom, who in one scene must be the movie's very amateur cinematographer. Mark's situation with his ex comes to a head with a big blow up that leads to him losing Joan as well, at least temporarily. A lot of the film now focuses on Mark editing Coven and getting ADR and Foley work for scenes where the sound wasn't so good, which appears to be a lot. So much is going on that frames and entire scenes go missing. We also see Mark at another job where he vacuums the floors of a mausoleum. The boss scared the hell out of him when he hired Mark because he said, "Mark, I hope this is the beginning of a long relationship." Meanwhile, the film has gotten to the take the kids to the editing room overnight and sleepover stage. It even appears his dad, once against the film, is now very adamant that Mark finish it. This leads to the awesome scene where Mark tries to get his very disinterested Uncle Bill to say his one line, "It's all right, it's okay, there's something to live for, Jesus told me so," which takes 30 imperfect tries before Bill gives up in disgust. Mike tells one of his acid overdose stories where he nearly died in the hospital and after he came to, wanted to drop the remaining acid he had in his pocket before his mom showed him she had it and flushed it down the toilet. Mike's drug stories are entertaining, but the message is clear. Don't do drugs, man. Super Bowl time. The Packers are beating the Patriots, and Mark is drinking a ton. This is probably one of the most unlikable moments in the film, as he goes over the top obnoxious and insulting, and he even wants Mike to use $20 of scratch-off winnings to go to a bar and buy four pitchers of beer that Mike would not even drink. On to the spring of 1997, more ADR work, including a vicious scream from Mike Shank that steals the entire movie. Mark begins shooting images for the flyers he's going to use to promote the film, which has a humorous mishap later when they stack some of the flyers on some newspapers that get taken away when the old newspapers are replaced with the new newspapers. We are reminded when the Oscars roll around that the previous year's nominees were almost all from independent features, although probably not as low budget and non-unionized like Mark's. He gets interviewed by a local newspaper. Mark's mom tells us that Mark's friend Ken is a bad influence on Mark and that he's a bad influence on Ken, and we are later taken to Mark picking up Ken from jail after serving time for some sort of crime that is never mentioned. Then we go on to more editing, ADR, and Foley work as they get closer to the film's premiere at a local theater. The promotions must have worked because Mark's about to show Coven to a packed house. The movie now shows us what amounts to a spoilery trailer of Coven and includes a lot of the scenes we saw getting shot earlier, finally in a fully edited picture. By the end of the picture, Mark is ready to make Northwestern, telling his Uncle Bill he needs 50 grand for this one. Bill seems okay with it, but it's sort of whatever. After he imparts some final words about what to do with your life, the movie informs us that Uncle Bill died on September 13th, 1997, and that he gave $50,000 in his will for Mark to make Northwestern, which as of this date has not been made. The movie ends with a bunch of clips of Mark's prior work before resigning to the credits. And that is American Movie. What did you guys think?
Since I haven't seen it, I'll go ahead and start. I loved this. I'm very, very thankful. This is, you know, exactly the kind of assignment on Wreckatopia that I love. I'll be honest, I don't think I'd ever really even heard of this movie until you assigned it. Like, it just completely slipped through my movie radar somehow. And it is so good, so insightful, and so sad as well. There's a lot of sadness in this documentary amongst, like, these lovable characters and kind of what they're going through and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I really was surprised by how much it feels like a mockumentary, even though it isn't a mockumentary. I even had to go back and check dates because it almost feels like Silent Bob is a take on this. Like, those two characters are these two guys, like their energy, their personalities, all that kind of stuff. But of course, that predates this by several years. And so that's really fascinating to me. Beavis and Butthead was another one that kind of came to mind, you know, but that predates this by several. It's like, you know, the actual people those things were based on were found somehow and put in front of us. I also think the movie has moments where the magic of what it means to create art comes through. Like, there are these moments where you go, okay, he may have had a lot of issues keeping him from, you know, pursuing this dream in a complete way or fulfilling it in a complete way or whatever, but he definitely had a vision. You watch some of those shots and you go, that's an interesting way to film that. It communicates something. Like, there's some real interesting art that's happening in there amongst the failure that I think is also something the movie is talking about. And honestly, in a better way than I feel like the Disaster Artist ever did. You know what I mean? Like, there's this thing that happens with some of the more popular bad movies, quote unquote, where I think things start to get, you know, we start to revel in things that actually aren't good because they aren't good in some ways. But I really think some of the things that this movie does with his work is genuinely good. I think some of those shots are genuinely interesting and genuinely good. So so I found that fascinating as well. Really, it's the moments, though, that make this just entertaining as all get out. Just the moments of the different quotes, different things like that. So, yeah, it's good stuff.
I think this movie is great. I think I hate this guy. I feel like it's interesting. I went back and looked at reviews when it came out, and it feels like most of the reviews are kind of calling it a celebration of the creative spirit, right? And I don't get that. And maybe it's just that culture has changed, and so the film reads differently in 2024 than it did in the 90s. I don't know. But like Aaron said, this movie makes me sad. This is like, everyone in this movie is sad. Everyone in this movie makes me sad. I think he should not be making terrible films. He should not be coercing his friends and family. That scene where he bullies his mom to come out when she's got a bunch of stuff to do pissed me off, because there was nothing in him in that moment that was about anyone else but himself. And the only redeeming moment, and I'm glad it's in there because we are all gray, we're not, none of us black or white, is when he bathes his elderly uncle on Thanksgiving. And that was a true moment, I think, of humanity and love. And if the movie doesn't have that, this guy's irredeemable for me in the way that he treats other people. The scene in the bank, felt like even the banker should have been stepping in saying, sir, are you being abused as an elderly person? The way he... I really, really find this guy unlikable. I think he probably has a mental illness. I'm not capable of diagnosing that from a 2-hour documentary, but I just don't think he acts like somebody who doesn't have a mental illness. I also want to talk about Mike a little bit, because I think Mike is the reason that this movie can feel like a mockumentary, because he is so gone from the drugs, man. Like, he is, I'm surprised he's even capable of making the decision to go sober and stick to it. He is so gone. And it almost plays like a Chris Farley character or something in the beginning. And then, of course, once he tells that bad acid trip story about the hospital, you're like, because then he goes, I got lots of stories like that. I got lots of stories like that. And it's just, it's so sad that he's never going to be who he was before the drugs. but he is a lovable guy. And I love that this documentary takes the time to subtly let us know he's really good at the guitar and he loves playing it. And it doesn't seem like anybody gives him any credit for it. He's almost always alone when he's doing it.
Well, he is the composer for this movie.
For the documentary?
Yeah, and all the little guitar strumming you hear throughout the...
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The whole movie is Mike Shank.
I think it's pretty telling that Mark's own brother says, I thought he would grow up to be a serial killer. Like, literally says that to the camera. Now, I think that brother's got some bitterness here. There's something going on there, because he doesn't have a single positive thing to say about Mark every time they interview him. But yeah, taking your kid to Apocalypse Now. Oh, he definitely stole that flower from the cemetery, even though he said he didn't. I'm just telling you, he did.
Joan's wise to it. She calls him out for it and just kind of lets him say whatever, and it's all right. Whatever. Well, okay, thanks for the
flower. One of the things I like about I'm sorry, is it Mike? Is his friend's name Mike? Is that right? I just slipped my brain. About Mike. Even as gone as he is, and maybe this is part of the reason, is he doesn't let him get away with that stuff sometimes. Like, there's one of my favorite parts of the movie. He says the guy took all our flyers, and he says, dude, that doesn't make any sense. And he just says, made sense to him. And he's right. Like, what do you mean that doesn't make any sense? It makes complete sense.
Yeah.
And so, like, there is that element of, like, he will ask him some, you know, he will ask Mike some sort of, you know, random question that's just all out there. And do you understand? And Michael just say no. Just respond with no. Great.
Yeah.
There's some great quotes in here. A couple that I wrote down. You got to one of them, Chris. The beginning of a long relationship. I love the delivery there where he pauses and goes, scared the hell out of me, man. I love in the beginning when he gets the IRS bill and he's got 10 days and he's like, luckily it's just $81. Like, what are they going to do? Take my Night of the Living Dead book? and then when he's punching up the script he says, and I love this line. I almost wish that he'd done it on purpose. He says, there's dialogue that would make the Pope weep. I've got to resurrect that, so to speak. just hilarious on accident. But man, he's just so unlikable to me, despite his vision and his ability to win the people around him over with his words. He doesn't win me over with his words, and I'm glad this movie exists. Not sure I like the main subject too much.
What's funny to me is how he'll so effortlessly go from one thing to another. When he's sort of asked what Coven is, and he's like, it's a black and white film shot on black and white on 16 millimeter negative direct market film, blah 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 blah. And then there's a point where he's just kind of like, all right, we're gonna do Coven. And then all of a sudden he goes, last night I was on the phone trying to talk to Tangiers in Morocco, trying to get the Casablanca or whatever. And he's like, what is that? You want to live your life like that, drinking peppermint schnapps and trying to call Morocco at 2 o'clock in the morning? Well, that's what happens, man. Anyway, so he goes right in. He just keeps segueing to all these different moments and everything. But yes, I agree. I kept. When I watched it this time, I was like, what is it like to deal with this guy when you don't have a condensed hour and 40 minutes to make him almost as likable as you can possibly get him? And then on the out, if you have to deal with this person hours on end, you probably do have to be one of his drinking buddies to get to tolerate this kind of thing. Yeah. for all that stuff. I mean, you know, that's another sad part of it too, is Mike, even though he's sitting there, you know, talking about sobriety and all that stuff, talking about how he met him. And he's like, you know, Mark was the only guy who would bring vodka around, and we would drink vodka together. And, you know, I was always happy when he came by because he had vodka around and all that. And it was like, yeah, geez, that is a sad thing. I agree that he can't, this person is unlikable, especially that Super Bowl scene where he's just over the top drunk at that point. And he's, you know, there's a point where his mom, who's just kind of like letting all this stuff slide right in front of her, is like, you know, he'll be okay tomorrow. And then he hears that and he goes, yep, I'll be okay tomorrow. And I'll be walking around the kitchen like you do. And like, you know, and he's like really, for a person who has to take a lot of odd jobs, very anti people who have those jobs.
Yeah.
Like, that's not him. That's other people. Yep. All right. Well, let's get on to our super secret double feature. We're going to have a lot of questions.
I did have one thing to say, and because I do have a final note that goes into what Jeremy was saying about how unlikable he is and those kind of things. And for me, it's not just so much that he's unlikable, but I think the movie a cautionary tale, or is it a celebration? Possibly both. But to me, it feels more like a cautionary tale in some ways of what it means to valorize this idea of independent filmmaking, right? You hear him talk in a positive way about having credit cards and maxing them out and owing people money, as if this is a positive thing in your life, because that's how you get stuff done. Because I've seen the stories of how people get movies made, and they talk about they had to max out 7 different credit cards before it all broke for them. And the problem is, that's 1 out of 100, 1 out of 1,000, 1 out of 10,000, where it actually breaks the right way. And in the other cases, there are destroyed lives and there are, you know, bad consequences. And I almost feel like this movie is willing to be that cautionary tale in some ways, where it's, you know, even the jerk stuff is kind of that, where it's like, and they, you know, they were demanding people and they demanded their, you know, actors do a certain way, and they had to be demanding to get it right. And it's like, I don't know, some of these things that we put on, like, the, you know, the hill of greatness, I don't know that they always need to be there, and it doesn't always work that way.
People talk about how David Fincher does 75 takes of every scene,
right?
Like,
yeah,
it's a positive quality, and I'm not sure it is. Like,
right.
70? Like, Maybe five. Yeah. I bet you've gotten most of what you're going to get after five. But so,
To me, that's like an OCD type of thing where it's like, I'm not sure I got the right thing. Right. Let's keep doing it.
Yeah,
and you're right. We do tell the story of Kevin Smith maxing out a credit card to make Clerks mm-hmm. in a positive light, but we shouldn't be encouraging people to do that.
Exactly.
And this in a weird way, Aaron. I don't know if you remember when we came out of Tick, Tick, Boom, how I felt about that movie's message.
Yeah.
At the time, I'm actually going to watch that movie today with my wife. Ironically, at the time, I've only seen it the once. I felt like the movie was saying, follow your dreams, God
right.
damn it. And it pissed me off because most people aren't as good as that guy. Most
right.
people aren't Jonathan Larson. Most people aren't Lin-Manuel Miranda. Mark is not Kevin Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Smith is not even a great analogy, but Mark is not, you know, a great
Tarantino
filmmaker.
Or whatever, yeah.
Right. It made me think of like those people on American Idol who are terrible singers who have nobody in their life willing to tell them, you're not good at this. You should do something else. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's another message also somewhere in here. I don't know. The movie is not making this message, but the non-democratization of making films, like it's too expensive to make a movie, like if you wanted to get it distributed and everything, like that's become more democratized as we've gotten into the iPhone era and YouTube era where people can shoot anything and edit anything and put it up on and to get it seen and everything. Back in this day, you know, this was, you know, you have to go, if you want to be a filmmaker, you have to go through a series of things to get to that point. You probably have to move to California. You probably have to wait tables for like several years. You probably have to do a lot of things that you have to punish yourself in a completely different environment to get to a point where you want to be. And that's not a reality. It's not going to be a reality for a lot of people. A lot of people are going to have to stay where they're at. And they're never going to get money for anything, no matter how much knowledge or whatever they show. And I want to try to speak as vaguely as possible about this, but we actually talked to somebody who was in a studio who said there's only like three or four good directors around. And I was like, I was stunned that he just said that like just out loud. Are you serious? Out of all the people in the world, there's only three or four good. Oh my God. Like, but that's just to them. Like those are the only people that they know about and are available and everything. Everybody else in the world who might be a great filmmaker, they're not going to go out and seek those people out, or, you know, they need it to land right in their laps a lot of time for this to happen. So there is something to be said about you having the dream of doing something that really, quite frankly, I hate using the word gatekeeping because it has become such a fucking stupid word now. But there is a real actual gatekeeping going on there where it's like, you know, now to keep somebody like Mark Borchardt out is probably a good thing, you know, after we've seen a movie like this. But there's people that are not like Mark who have way more talent, who have way more insight, all that stuff, who will never, ever make it because of whatever stupid reason. And I feel like there is a message there somewhere in there, even though, you know, our subject matter may not be the best case.
Yeah. Well, in most importantly, $2 plus a potato is $2. And that, I think, is really what we need to take from this. Yeah.
Honestly, the lottery part was really hard to watch too, man.
It was.
And like you've got this tiny amount of money and you're doing that. Oh.
Yeah.
A couple more things before we get into other stuff here, but Aaron, you were talking about Mark and like how, I can't remember, you were saying something about like he seems to have a vision or whatever.
I thought some of those shots looked pretty cool.
Yeah, the shots look cool, but there was also the moment where he talks about Northwestern and how he's talking about the houses are decaying, the land is decaying, the cars are decaying, and these characters are decaying. Mm. And it was like one of the first like feels like cogent moments.
Yes.
Where he's actually talking about his film in an artistic type of way rather than a dream way. Mm-hmm. Like, imagine this being on a screen somewhere and you want, you know. And so that was one of those things. And in the, I used to have the DVD of this movie, and long story short, I lost all of my DVDs a long time ago, but and I'm talking about DVDs, not my Blu-rays and all that other stuff. The DVD of American Movie had Coven on it. You could watch the full Coven. Mm. So if anybody was out there looking for that movie, it's on the DVD if you can locate that. But I also, back in the day, used to listen to the commentary on this movie, and I remember them talking about how one of the things that Mark was very concerned about, like, was in his you know, rural area and everything, was like how all the stuff, all the trees and land and everything is just getting bought up, and like all these houses are springing up and everything, and there's not going to be a time where he can shoot the Northwestern that he really wants to shoot, because all the places that he had in mind for the movie are not going to be there anymore and everything. So there is some deepness there, even though there's a lot of unlikability. Mm-hmm. For sure.
I agree.
All right. What is your super, let's go to the super secret double feature. Mm-hmm.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
So I have one that I really, really love.
Do
and
it.
And I have a backup that has already been mentioned in the chat. So if I steal yours, I'm sorry, but I want to
I go have
first.
I don't know my I have a game time decision to make. So That's I'll wait till after you to make my call.
My super, super secret double feature is Rushmore. I actually wrote a note that Mark is like Jason Schwartzman character in Rushmore, only with less talent. Because the Schwartzman character in that movie bullies his friends and family into helping him make these ornate productions. The difference is he's actually talented. His productions are good, whereas Mark's are not. But they are spiritual brothers in my mind, in terms of how they behave, how the vision matters more than anyone's feelings around them. Just could not shake that movie the entire time I was watching this. So thank you, Aaron, for letting me use Rushmore.
Yeah.
Both of those came out around the same time, too. Rushmore, I think, was 98. Oh, I mean, it had an official 99 release, though. Like, I think it was 98 for, like, film festivals and stuff like that, and then 99 had like a major release, so it came out around the same time as this did.
Okay, you know, my brain went to a few places. First thing I thought of was Napoleon Dynamite, just because it feels similar on a geographical kind of way with the way people talk and those kind of things. I went to the idea of maybe that Troll 2 documentary, Best Worst Movie, whatever, kind of feels similar in some ways. But I landed on a couple that I really like, and I guess I'll say the one I didn't go with first, which is one that you may not have heard of called Dick Johnson is Dead. This is on Netflix and is a real interesting testament to what it takes to make a documentary with somebody you love. And a lot of the Bill stuff in this reminded me of the Dick Johnson stuff in Dick Johnson is Dead. So I wanted to give that a
I think you just like saying Dick Johnson.
His name is Dick Johnson. middle name Roger. The one I decided to finally go with is Val. And I don't know if you got a chance to check this out, but this is a Val Kilmer documentary. And to me, Val Kilmer is an interesting story. I learned so much about him in this documentary because for as famous as he was and as successful as he was, I don't think he was famous and successful in the way that he wanted to be famous and successful. Like he had this other artistic side to him that this documentary explores that feels a lot like the American movie kind of thing, where It just didn't work out that way for him. It wasn't, you know, he has this level of kind of arrogant confidence to him in the early parts of this documentary. Basically, if you don't know what it is, he filmed everything in his life. So, yeah. This has you know, lots of film that you haven't seen about what it was like growing up and being a superstar when he was. So, anyways, Val is really great and feels like a good feature with this.
Nice.
That's a really good one. The only thing I hate about Val is that when he gets to Top Secret, there's like just one blurb about Top Secret. Yeah. And it was like, I'm doing this movie that nobody understands or some shit like that. And I was like, man, come on. You have to have more thoughts about Top Secret than that. Top Secret is hilarious, and you're hilarious
That's
in it, Val
right.
Kilmer.
Amazing.
Okay. Next week it's going to be Jeremy's turn. So, Jeremy, what is going to be our big recommend, our homework for next week?
Only one movie has been accidentally small recommended twice by me on Recotopia. And that movie is The Founder, starring Michael Keaton. And we are finally going to big recommend and dive into this movie that I find to be very enjoyable, quirky, quaint, despite kind of showing us an asshole taking a company from a couple of beloved brothers. This is the story of McDonald's and how Ray Kroc found the McDonald's brothers, franchised his own, and ultimately arm wrestled the entire company away from these two guys. So it is not, it's not flattering, but it kind of is. I don't know if you guys have even seen this movie, but I'm excited to dive into it with the Recotopia hat on and take some notes. This is free to watch everywhere you can watch free stuff. Tubi, Philo, Pluto, Sling, Plex, the CW for some reason, Fubo TV. So you may have commercials, but you won't have to pay to watch this one. So that's what we're going to talk about next week. The Founder.
Still haven't seen it. I have the Blu-ray. I still haven't seen it. So this will be my first time watching it. So looking forward to that. By the way, Jeremy, it seems to be a lot of the people who want to know what your backup super secret double feature was to American Movie.
Oh, Ed Wood.
Oh yeah, for sure. In fact, that someone there was a point where I saw an interview with Mark Borchardt after this movie, and someone compared him to Ed Wood, and he's like, "Do you know who Ed Wood is?" And he's like, "Well, I know," and he obviously deflecting here because he knows who the fuck Ed Wood is, but like. He goes, I know about the movie with Johnny Depp in it, and that's about all he said about that. So I remember that back in the day. All right, looks like we have time for a question or two.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What's your favorite movie that's totally up its own ass?
For this one, I went with Inception. I think Nolan in general might be an answer for a lot of people.
Like Inception?
Yes.
Listen,
it works on multiple levels.
It does. Holy shit.
In fact, that joke works on multiple levels.
It does.
Well.
It does. I get you. I get it, Aaron. I get it.
But in all honesty, I do feel like Nolan has a tendency to conceptualize his movies in a way that make them feel pretentious when you swipe the incredible filmmaking away from them and go, oh, I see what you're doing here, buddy. And Inception to me is, pretension prime in that way, because what he's trying to do is so complex, so nuanced. I think all the movie theories around it and that kind of stuff is probably testament to that as well. But I love it. I love that movie so much. Watch it all the times.
Yeah, for sure.
I could do. I could say Tenet like Castriff just did in the chat. I even tweeted after I watched Tenet for the first time that's about as much as I can enjoy a movie that's totally up its own ass. But I think I have to go with the Matrix sequels, Reloaded and the third one, whatever that one's called.
Well, especially the last one that came out.
Resurrections, I mean,
yeah.
They're all, I mean, after the first one, they just got a little too self-indulgent. I adore the second and the third one, not the fourth. I adore them, but it's just too much. Everything is just too much. They just didn't say no enough. But I love those movies.
Mine is Unbreakable. This is tailor-made for M. Night Shyamalan as well. I love Unbreakable, but you can really tell that he's taken that Sixth Sense goodwill that he has, and he has just ramped it up to 11 on that one, where it's just like, I'm going to show you how great a filmmaker I can be on this. And luckily the source material is up to the task for him to do all of that in there. I would say Signs, by the way. This would be Signs if it was a movie that I enjoyed whatsoever. I don't like Signs at all. But Signs is the one that's truly M. Night's up his own ass movie that I have ever seen. Yep. So, over in the chat, I know Aaron is like dying to
talk
about
it's okay.
Signs
Everybody
right
gets to love what they love and hate what they hate.
No. He's dying. He's like, oh, you guys are totally wrong about Signs. Let me tell you why. Nolan says The Fall Guy was totally up its own ass, but I loved it. Eight says Fast 4-10. Are you sure those are your favorite movies, Eights, or are you just coming up with movies that are on up its own ass? Let's see. Link says Tenet. When Tenet was brought up during the Inception talk. Tenet for sure. My God. Although it wouldn't be one of my favorite movies when we talk about that. James says Cloud Atlas will win. Whoa, that's a good one, because I don't personally like Cloud Atlas, but I know a lot of people who do. And even if you do, you have to admit that movie is very much up its own ass.
I don't think I like it, but I've seen it 5 times. That says something. I keep going back for something. I just keep forgetting, but yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. Josh says, I'm going to go with Apocalypse Now. You take that back. Shaggy says Dune. Yeah, I can see that. But yeah, going back to Apocalypse Now, I can totally see it. And we have proof of it when, you know, there's a documentary about how up Francis Ford Coppola's own ass he was when he made the movie.
Yeah.
Lolly says Signs is beautiful. Yeah, it's beautiful, but it sucks. And then furthermore, more people having love.
Swing away, Meryl.
Swing away, baby.
Yep. That's right. All right. That's going to do it for this week. Next week's homework is The Founder. Looking forward to seeing that. Once again, chat, thank you guys for coming out and bringing it again for us on this one. Good discussion about not only the movie we were talking about, but Hundreds of Beavers. Glad that you could bring that up. That was really, really cool of you guys to do that. We'll see you next week. See you guys.
Bye, guys.
See ya. Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Aaron didn't get the whiteout memo.
Mm-mm. Sorry. Not on my agenda.
We're trying to fill the whole stadium with people in white shirts to white out the opponent because it's really intimidating, but you ruined it.
I apologize for that. I don't know. I don't know that I have a white shirt.
Well, that's one of the strangest things I've ever heard you say.
Is it?
Yeah. Why would you not?
Don't like white shirts.
But even like men's basic t-shirts that you put under like a dress shirt, those are white.
Yeah, all black. All mine are black. Gray, maybe.
Like your soul.
Like my soul. Yes. Exactly. Thanksgiving was Thanksgiving. It was it was family and food and the Lions trying to lose a game and all sorts of fun stuff. So yeah,
man,
it was good.
You have no idea how happy I was this morning when I looked out the window and saw that the trash guy took all my garbage, because we do Thanksgiving and Christmas at the same time in my family. And so we had my brother and his wife and three kids, and then my wife and I and my parents. So we did a big Thanksgiving meal, regular meals, then Christmas. So I had like 12 bags of garbage more than would fit in my outdoor garbage can. Mm. And like the rules on the website say they won't take anything that's not like in the can.
Mm-hmm.
But he took it. I've put a big pile of bags out there and he took it. I'm very excited.
Yeah, playing the garbage game is fun this time of year. We just like every week, is everything that we can get in there in there? Is everything that we can get in there in there? And then, you know, yeah. By January, it's like, oh, we've got a full empty bin again.
You run the dishwasher like three times a day. Like, it was absurd, but it was fun.
I know this isn't convenient, but there are those places that you can go and dump your trash.
Mm-hmm.
If you had an overload and you didn't want to have it wait around for a whole week and all that. So there are those places that you can just go and be like, hey, I got a couple bags of trash. What are you going to do? And then they just like, you know, to like in, direct you over.
I can't believe I'm about to make a reference to Lovely Bones.
Like oh, the, God.
Like that pit in Lovely Bones
yeah.
Where you shove the refrigerator.
Yeah.
Instead of going to the dump, my parents just keep bringing shit to us every Thanksgiving. Like, here's a jar of Mount St. Helens ash that we for 50 years. When I'm disposing of like criminal waste, I don't throw that in my own garbage.
Right.
Like I dispose of that myself, like in Goodfellas.
You don't want to have Otto the garbage man pick it up, like Samuel Jackson says. I saw Pulp Fiction again on the big screen at Belcourt, which is
nice.
was cool. But I was thinking about, but when I first watched this movie, I was working at a movie theater that had it, and I got to see it for free. And ever since then, I've bought a Laserdisc, a Blu-ray, a 4K steelbook, and I've paid for it on the big screen. Like, negating all of that time that I had to see it for free back in the day when it came out.
Mm-hmm. Pulp Fiction's a strange movie for me because what a rush the first time I saw that movie. My God. Mm-hmm. I was still pretty young as a moviegoer because, again, I didn't see a lot of movies in high school. But I had never experienced that kind of feeling walking out of a movie.
Same.
And yet time for me has not been kind to that movie. I find it hard to watch, like, lately.
In particular, the racial slur angle of it is hard to watch because this isn't like, you know, woke Chris here or anything like that. I'm not like, hey, everybody gather around. Let's hear woke Chris talk about how Tarantino used the N-word in his movies. It really felt like an edgelord type of thing watching it this time.
Mm.
It felt like, well, I can say it. Yep. People do talk this way. So therefore everybody talks this way. And it was like, You have the Eric Stoltz drug dealer saying it. You have Tarantino himself saying it several times, right in front of Samuel Jackson. Like, you know, like, I mean, what's to keep Samuel Jackson from just blowing that guy away and just saying, we'll dump him in the Joe's monster truck and tow too. because, and it's just a lot of people who are saying it because, well, people do talk that way. So therefore I will put it in everything. And it's like, no, I mean, it you just really felt like you were trying to get away with it. You knew you could get away with it, so you just did it. And now it, you know, it when you watch the movie now, yeah, it really feels like, especially watching it with a crowd, it feels very uncomfortable watching.
I bet
it.
Yeah, I had Hateful Eight on a couple days ago, and that movie's full of the N-word. Like,
yeah,
it feels like they're just movies where he starts out saying, this is a world where this word is used, so I will use it 20 times more than necessary.
Right.
Even Django Unchained.
Yeah, and in Django it makes sense, but at the same time, that's another one of those situations where it's like, well, people talk like that. Well, they may have talked like that, but I don't know if they said it every other word talked like that. Maybe they did, but we don't need it to enjoy the movie or anything. No. It's not like I watched Django Unchained and you know what was really missing from that movie?
That would have been an A+ if they just had a little bit more.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't have nearly time enough probably to go down this road, but it does remind me of a conversation I've been having a lot again recently of, like, you know, the characters in a movie, you know, what the realism is supposed to be in order for you to be able to connect to them, whether it be, you know, violence or language or sexuality or whatever it is, like this idea that, you know, well, that's how it is in the real world, so we should be able to have art about it, is probably true. But there's this interesting thing that happens to the story itself the more you labor it with, you know, those kind of things, that it becomes a distraction in some ways. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's you know, for instance, I just watched Baby Girl. Without getting into a lot of the details, it, you know, it deals with some sexual power dynamics, politics kind of things with the characters, but it doesn't really deal with it. It just lets, you know, you kind of process it through the movie, which is fine, but I kind of need the movie to do a little bit of the work of going, okay, here's what I'm saying to you, or here's what I'm presenting to you, and, you know, to have a point of view, at least something, like a seed of a point of view on something sometimes when you kind of wade into those waters. But yeah, I think it's the same as with anything. Art can be whatever art's going to be, but, you know, you kind of have to deal with the consequences based on, you know, different kinds of audiences who watch it. So, yeah.
I felt the same way, by the way, about the movie 42, which, you know, the Alan Tudyk character,
sure,
in 42, you know, I don't know how accurate that was. I know that it was, like, really, really, like, super bad. So they were trying to show you, like, yeah, this was how bad it was. But that, even that is one of those where you don't need, like, you know, like, that much, I guess, because you're never going to really know what it's like to be Jackie Robinson.
Right, right.
You know, you're never really, even if you threw as much out there as you possibly could, you're never going to, I think just a few slurs here and there would have been fine. And but it seemed like they kept wanting to go back to Alan Tudyk saying the stuff that he's saying in the dugout while anytime he went to bat.
What's the movie that's a bunch of short, raunchy movies where Hugh Jackman has balls on his chin?
Movie 43.
Movie 43.
So when you said 42, I pictured movie 43.
Oh, God.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.